I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Civil asset forfeiture allows law enforcement to seize cars, cash, homes, and other property that they claim have been the result of criminal activity, most notably drug dealing. The police can either sell or keep the property that's been seized, even though the owners haven't been arrested or even convicted of a crime. And while it's been used largely to go against or go after drug kingpins, it's also ensnared ordinary citizens, even those who have nothing to do with the alleged crime. Most of them give up after trying to get their assets returned because the process is so onerous. Now, Philadelphia has changed its use of civil asset forfeiture as a result of a plea agreement, while other counties in Pennsylvania have not. WHYY's Bobby Allen covered how Berks County, north of Philadelphia, has been using civil asset forfeiture in a story for Keystone Crossroads, and he joins us on Radio Times to tell us what he found. Bobby Allen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You looked at Berks County, specifically at Reading, Pennsylvania. For those people not familiar with this part of the Commonwealth, describe this county for us.
Yeah, so Berks County's largest city is Reading. In the wake of deindustrialization and white flight, Reading has had a really hard time finding its economic footing. There's a greater concentration of SNAP recipients, people on food stamps, there than any place else in the country. It's a really struggling place. It's the demographics have changed drastically over the years. A lot of Hispanics have moved to this part of Berks County. And the reason why we focus there is because my WHYY colleague Ryan Briggs and I, we're interested in finding what is going on with civil asset forfeiture in places other than Philadelphia. And we found in places like Berks County and other places throughout Pennsylvania and outlying places like Lancaster County, Montgomery, Delaware, Lehigh, this practice is just being ramped up just as it was going down in Philadelphia. So we really zoomed in on Berks because they're taking more cash from people per capita than any other place in the state.
They also have a very outspoken district attorney, a guy named John T. Adams. Who is he?
Yeah, so John T. Adams is the longtime district attorney there, and he's a former probation officer who He likes bragging about how he used to chase down scofflaws on foot to catch them himself. He's kind of a tough-talking, hard-nosed prosecutor. He even told us that he occasionally will accompany some of his investigators on, kicking down doors and doing drug raids himself. And he says, look, civil asset forfeiture is a way to deprive drug kingpins of their money. It's a way to cut into their economic revenue, and it's a way to take drugs off the streets. And he's not ashamed of this. I mean, in fact, he says, the fact that Berks County is number one in Pennsylvania is a point of pride to John T. Adams.
Interesting. Well, let's hear from him directly, basically saying, Bobby, what you just said, he said. And this is John T. Adams, again, speaking with our guest, and he's Berks County District Attorney.
If we do not have a method to take away the fruits of the illicit labor of drug dealers, they're going to continue to deal their poison, and people are going to continue to die.
And that's an argument that I think for a lot of district attorneys would justify something like civil asset forfeiture.
Yeah, that's right. So what we found in Berks County is, reflected in counties across Pennsylvania, which is that this civil asset forfeiture, which is basically a legal mechanism that allows prosecutors to, without criminal charges, to take someone's assets, right? And we focused on cash, but, police and prosecutors are taking homes, they're taking cars, they're taking other possessions, and that money is funneled sometimes directly into the salaries. It's helping to subsidize salaries of law enforcement. It's paying for bonuses. It's paying for equipment. And civil rights lawyers have long said that it flips the Constitution on its head, that it's extremely problematic and ought to be abolished. And a number of states have responded to that and enacted controls. But in Pennsylvania, there was, a proposal to reform it. It got kind of watered down, and we found that, since that reform passed in Harrisburg, the practice has gone down in Philly, but like I said, has really, really been ratcheted up in other parts of Pennsylvania. And this guy we're talking about, John T. Adams, really is the face of that ramp up in outlying counties in Pennsylvania.
Your story begins with a drug bust. A guy, Velez and Cruz, they're in a car. They've got a bag of heroin and something like $5,000. What happens next?
Yeah, so, this is an example where investigators, they are going in to try to take someone who they suspect of being involved in drugs. And not only are they taking the drugs that they find, but they took a vehicle and they impounded it, and they had plans of auctioning that vehicle and using the proceeds to fund their department. But here's the rub. The vehicle did not belong to the drug suspect. It belonged to the drug suspect's girlfriend, who now lives in Connecticut, is an honor student in college, has been trying hard to get the vehicle back. And that's why we did this story, because of the innocent people who are caught in the middle. There's a lot of collateral victims, frankly, innocent people, never been charged with a crime, let alone convicted of a crime, whose stuff is taken. And the process of getting it back is just so grueling and time consuming. And unlike a criminal proceeding, there's no right to counsel. You have no right to an attorney. So people are filling out these petitions to try to get their stuff back by themselves.
Well, this was a car then that belonged to the girlfriend of one of the guys sitting in the car. As you said, she was an honor student at a college in Connecticut. Did she get her car back, Bobby?
Yeah. So after we questioned Berks County DA about this, he admitted that the car is going to be returned to her. But only after questions, only after staying on the DA's case about, hey, you told us, DA, that you are not taking the property of people who are innocent. Here's an example of someone who is innocent. And, you know, it's kind of a concession that, well, when you really pull the petitions and read one after another, you do find people who had never been charged, whose property is being taken, and in this case was planned to be used for revenue. But, you know, we intercepted it before it could be used, you know, auctioned off. And I guess the woman's going to get her car back.
Well, and apparently was returned to her, quote unquote, despite the evidence.
Right. Exactly.
So reluctantly returned.
Exactly.
You also profiled a woman named Dana Smith.
Yeah. So Dana Smith lives in a sleepy rural part of Berks County, and she got a knock on her door. And early in the morning, and she looked out, and there was a row of police vehicles. She had no idea what was going on. They told her they had a warrant to search her house. They suspected she had a drug trafficking operation out of the house. She said she never did. They found no drugs, but they did find $3,000. It was shortly after she got her tax refund, and she was going to use that money to pay for her son's prom. They took the money and said, if you want this back, you're going to have to go to court. And years later, she filed petitions by herself. She showed up to court. She said, I have no drugs. I was never charged with a crime. You raided my house and never charged me. I need my money back. They cut a deal with her, giving her half of the money back, not even the full
$1,500.
Yeah, not even the full $3,000. And this has really colored her view of law enforcement in Berks County. It has really affected the way that she sees police in her community. And she thinks she was unfairly targeted.
What is, though, the response then of District Attorney John T. Adams to these two particular cases?
Yeah, so the practice is so prevalent, and there are so many petitions that he's saying, you know, focusing on the innocent people who are caught in the middle, those are anomalies. That's sort of a red herring. He said what you should be focusing on are the major drug kingpins, the major drug operations that they are disrupting, and they are doing that. I mean, he talks about going into homes, knocking down the drywall, and finding in excess of $1 million and lots of drugs. That does happen. And he's able to seize the bank accounts of these drug dealers. He is able to use this practice in a way that does put a dent in major drug operations. But when it comes to these innocent people caught in the middle, I mean, he honestly doesn't have a sufficient response, in my view. He just says, you know, they shouldn't associate with drug dealers. He said, you know, the only reason you are on our radar, innocent person, is because you have some association to a drug dealer. So if you want to stay out of our view, then don't talk and associate with drug dealers. And to these innocent people, that's preposterous, right?
How do people in Reading, though, feel about it? And this is a poor city, as you mentioned, and I'm sure coming with that poverty are problems of crime. Do they support what the DA is doing?
Yeah, we talked to people on the streets of Reading, and views are mixed. We talked to a bodega clerk who said, look, I'm happy the DA is doing this. I don't want drug dealers on the streets. I think if you have drug money, that's tainted money, it ought to be taken. And if it's paying bills that taxpayers would be on the hook for otherwise, great. Then you talk to other folks who say, you know, this is just a form of harassment. Police shouldn't have a financial incentive to be searching my pockets for money that they could use for their budgets. That seems like it's a conflict of interest, to say the least. So it really depends, right? I mean, it's not – we didn't find a consistent for or against on the streets of Reading. Views are quite mixed.
Let me play another clip from your piece. And again, this is John T. Adams talking about using this money from civil asset forfeiture to essentially help run the department.
And frankly, I'd have never been able to obtain that equipment if I had to rely on a municipal budget or a county budget or a state budget.
So what he's saying there, Bobby, is that he needs this money for his department to essentially run the department.
That's exactly right. And it's to district attorneys, it's an appealing idea, right? They are able to use what he has said, bad guys' money to find other bad guys, right? What he was basically saying in the tape we just heard is that if we didn't have this practice, if this law was changed and we weren't allowed to do this, who would be paying for our equipment, our bonuses, our drug task force salaries? You, the taxpayer. We're saving taxpayers' money. And that's a message that he takes, to community meetings and in public speaking events. He says, civil asset forfeiture gets a bad rap when litigation and news reports expose the perils of it. But he says it's a way to save taxpayers' money.
He also said, I guess infamously, that Reading is not a nice community. It is a mess. This is what he told
you,
Bobby.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, he makes no bones about the fact that Reading is a tough, hard place, and that crime really is an issue. And he says because there's such a drug and crime problem in Reading, he has no choice but to look everywhere he can for what he calls illicit money. Right.
We're going to be talking more about Philadelphia and also beyond Pennsylvania. But it sounds like what you found, Bobby, is that in suburban and rural communities, not Philadelphia necessarily, that's where civil asset forfeiture really has gained support, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And so we found specifically in Berks County, which is about 400,000 people, over 5 years, they brought in nearly $5 million. So think of that.
Real money.
400,000 people, they brought in $5 million in forfeiture revenue. And that's after they auction off, dozens of cars. They take cash out of people's pockets. This is a practice that I think if you stopped any person in Pennsylvania and ask them about this, they probably would be surprised that it exists. It does operate in the shadows, and especially in rural and outlying counties in Pennsylvania. But the law allows it. I want to make this really clear. The prosecutors are not doing anything illegal. They have the law on their side. But we've just found it interesting when we really dig into the individual cases and found people who are caught in the middle.
Well, on that note, we're going to end our conversation. I should say to our listeners that this is Bobby Allen's last day at WHYY.
I'm happy to be here, Marty.
Moving on to NPR. Thanks for all your reporting here at WHYY. And to our listeners, check out Bobby's story in Keystone Crossroads about civil asset forfeiture in Berks County. We're going to take a very short break, and we've got another guest who's furiously taking notes, and we'll be talking more about civil asset forfeiture after this very short break. And just stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A Cato Institute survey conducted a few years ago found that 84% of Americans oppose civil asset forfeiture, defined as, quote, police taking a person's money or property that is suspected to have been involved in a drug crime before the person is convicted of a crime. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled recently on a case involving civil asset forfeiture that local law enforcement has to limit its ability to seize assets. Justice Ginsburg, citing the Eighth Amendment, wrote, "The protection against excessive fines has been a constant shield through Anglo-American history. Exorbitant tolls undermine other constitutional liberties." Well, we've been talking about how Pennsylvania has been using civil asset forfeiture, and we want to broaden our conversation with our guest, Lou Rulli. He's a practice professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, has represented clients trying to get their assets returned. And Lou Rulli, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to make sure we're all on the same page. How do you define civil asset forfeiture?
So civil asset forfeiture is the permanent taking of property by law enforcement, the government, without even having to charge or convict a person of a crime. It is a really a legal fiction that the property has done wrong, and therefore the government is entitled to seize and forfeit that property permanently to the government. Despite the civil liberties of individuals who may not be involved in any criminal activity.
Is it a drug activity or is it any criminal? Can this be applied to any kind of alleged criminal activity?
Well, what we're talking about mostly is drug activity. However, there are a whole series of civil forfeiture laws that can apply to other kinds of criminal activity. But really what Bobby was talking about earlier and what we see most frequently on the streets is the question of drug activity.
Is it a kind of a vestige of the war on drugs then? Is that where it really became, quote-unquote, popular?
Absolutely. It begins at the very beginning of our country. Civil forfeiture was a concept used in the maritime setting. Ships that were involved in customs violations, piracy on the seas, famous case of the Supreme Court in the 1800s, a Spanish vehicle that was engaged in that kind of illegal activity, the government seized the ship. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that this action was against the ship, they could seize it, and that that complied with the Constitution because the owners were in Europe. We couldn't get jurisdiction over the owners in Europe, and so we could grab the tools of their illegal activity. And for most of our country, that's where it was limited. But in the 1970s, with the war on drugs, Congress decided to use this very powerful weapon to try to gain control over drug activity in this country with the notion that if we went against large criminal enterprises engaged in drug activity, the kingpins, as we say, that we could take away the tools of their trade and make some real headway in the war on drugs. And so the thought is a good one, but in reality, over the decades, that's not the profile largely of how civil forfeiture is used.
And I do want to get to that. I'm still stuck on civil asset forfeiture. Shouldn't it be civil asset seizure?
It begins with seizure.
In that the government is seizing the assets.
The police seize the property, and then the district attorney's office, the prosecutors, bring a forfeiture action. It's a civil action, not a criminal action. It doesn't have the safeguards that a criminal action has. And if they prevail in that forfeiture action, then they permanently own the property. And most importantly, they get, in most of the states, all of the proceeds from that taking. That means that the law enforcement agents who are making the decision whether to bring a civil forfeiture action are actually financially benefiting from that decision, as we heard, in order to increase the revenue that's flowing to prosecutor offices.
If we're talking about civil lawsuits, then it's about preponderance of evidence. So the evidence is a different measurement, and also you're not entitled to free legal counsel, right? So you have to pay for your own lawyer.
The real problem here with civil forfeiture laws is that they're stacked against ordinary citizens in favor of the government in many ways, and you've pointed out a couple. Number one, you don't need a criminal conviction in order to forfeit property. Number two, since it's not a criminal case, there is no right to counsel. People who are too poor to afford counsel will go without counsel. And often the amount seized doesn't justify hiring private counsel. The standard of proof is so low that the government, it's too easy for the government to win a case against innocent people. And these are all areas that states are looking at and beginning to reform because the law is unduly harsh when it's applied against ordinary citizens.
So the government takes your money, and in order to prove that you did nothing wrong, let's say you're innocent in this case, as Bobby described in a couple of instances in his story, that you have to prove that you did nothing wrong to get it back. It really does turn this guilt-innocence thing on its head.
Absolutely. Our whole judicial system is premised on the notion innocent until proven guilty. And if the government thinks we're guilty of something, they have to prove it. But in civil forfeiture, it is indeed the burden of the property owner to prove that they are innocent of any wrongdoing. And that's a difficult thing to prove. And so some states have begun to shift that burden. Pennsylvania is one of those, in which the burden rightfully belongs on the government to prove the wrongdoing of the property owner rather than the property owner having to prove their innocence.
You were involved in a famous or maybe infamous case involving $98 in a piggy bank. What was that about?
Well, it's just a great example. You know, the police went into a home of a mom who had nothing to do with any criminal activity. And she was not charged with any criminal activity, but there were allegations that a neighbor was using her house in some way for low, you know, level drug activity. And when the police came in, they searched the house and they seized any cash they can find. And what they found was her little daughter's piggy bank. She had just had a birthday party and she had $95. Mostly in single bills in that piggy bank. They took it. They wouldn't give it back. Our clinic at the University of Pennsylvania Law Students, where we have law students represent folks, it took our clinic almost 2 years and at least 12 court appearances before we were able to get that $95 piggy bank back.
And was the $95 in the piggy bank?
Yes, it was. And so that got returned, but you can see that no person who is on limited means is working can afford to take off from work that many times. No one can afford to hire a lawyer to get that kind of return. And so what we're seeing in civil forfeiture is a very high level of default rates. Congress studied this problem and found that as many as maybe 80% of civil forfeiture cases end in a default judgment in favor of the government. People just give up. They don't contest. And they don't often because it's so onerous to do so, it's costly to do so, there's no right to counsel, the burdens of proof are stacked against them. It's a law that desperately needs reform. And I'm glad to say that as the press has given it more scrutiny and more Americans are finding out about what's going on, 31 states since 2014 have begun to enact reforms in varying ways to address the abuses of civil forfeiture.
Well, I was thinking the last time you were on the show, we were talking about Philadelphia and actually debating this issue, and there have been some changes to how Philadelphia deals with civil asset forfeiture. So it's interesting to use, I guess, this city as an example of what looks like is happening in different parts of the country. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lou Rooley. He's practiced professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, has represented clients trying to get their assets returned in cases involving civil asset forfeiture. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. And we're curious about where you stand on this particular issue and if you have been caught up in the civil asset forfeiture law such as it is. Let me get Stephanie from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Stephanie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I just wanted to share. This actually happened to my brother and I about 3 years ago. We live in Philadelphia. We bought an investment property in Point Breeze neighborhood. And about 2 weeks after we closed, I arrived at the property to change the locks, and I found that someone else had done that for me and that I couldn't actually enter the property anymore. There was a giant red note, orange notice on the door that said that the property had been seized by Seth Williams and that I could contact him directly if I had any questions or concerns. So I contacted the district attorney's office and explained that I was a brand new owner, that I had no idea what was going on and I needed more information. They ended up signing us an attorney who explained that the previous tenants of the previous landlord had about $50,000 worth of barbiturates going in and out of the property.
Wow.
And I just had to prove basically that we had transferred title. But all in all, it took about 4 months for us to clear the lien and to get our property back and for me to be able to fully access it. And, you know, overall, I just think this puts a huge burden on property owners and landlords and parents and grandparents to basically be sure that all of their assets, including cars, properties, everything, are completely drug-free. And I just think that that's totally unfair.
Well, Stephanie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We should say that Seth Williams, the previous district attorney, there is a new district attorney now, Larry Krasner, here in Philadelphia. But let me give Lou Rulli a chance to respond to your story. What do you say, Lou?
Well, first, thank you for that story. It's a story that was repeated many times in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was a hotspot for civil forfeiture assets being seized. And I just want to point out, between 2002 and 2012, for example, during that decade, 1,268 houses were forfeited to the district attorney's office, 3,473 cars, $47.8 million in cash, for a total of $68.8 million forfeited from Philadelphians to the district attorney's office. So you can see the enormity of this problem. And I'm sorry that you were caught up with it, but the good news, at least for you, was that you were able to get it resolved.
Right.
But for many other Philadelphians, they lost their homes, they lost their cars, and they lost their cash. And that's why civil forfeiture asset reform is so important. And you noted that the district attorney assigned you a lawyer. Well, they didn't assign a lawyer who was representing your interests. They may have ultimately given it back to you. But the reality is that for many other innocent owners, they lost their home, either because they weren't able to navigate the process to get their property back, or because the district attorney's office refused to give it back, and they prevailed in court.
Stephanie, thanks for the call. And I should say, with Larry Krasner, has taken a different approach to civil asset forfeiture. And it looks like, Lou, it's really only for major criminal cases, not for some small, low-level cases.
Well, what's interesting here is that our district attorney campaigned on the notion of ending civil forfeiture in Philadelphia, and really representing the more modern and prevailing thought that this law is abusive for many of the reasons we really talked about, but particularly because when you look at the amount of proceeds that can be derived from civil forfeiture from ordinary citizens, it's so alluring to district attorneys because it boosts their budgets. In Philadelphia, as much as 20% of the salaries of the district attorney's office were being fueled by the civil forfeiture machine here in Philadelphia. And this is not unique to Philadelphia. You know, we saw this around the country as well. And as you're hearing earlier in this program, it's happening particularly in suburban and more rural counties now because district attorneys recognize the real benefits financially to their offices from civil forfeiture.
But what's interesting is that there are three states, I think you said they all begin with the letter N, who have basically gotten rid of civil asset forfeiture.
That's correct. So since 2014, three states, North Carolina, New Mexico, and Nebraska, have abolished civil forfeiture. 16 states in total have required a criminal conviction before the forfeiture of property. Almost no state guarantees the right to counsel, which is another area that needs attention. And a number of the states have begun to change the burden of proof from the low level of preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing evidence. And so that's really important. But I really think the crux of this is a question of does the money go to law enforcement, or does the money go to the general treasury, or to education, where it is accountable by the people, where it's visible and transparent, where there are safeguards to make sure that the abuses do not occur. As long as the money continues to go to law enforcement, the people who are making these decisions, we're going to continue to see abuse of civil forfeiture.
Because it's a conflict of interest? Is that what you're saying?
It really is. It's just in a world of stagnant budgets, this is a funding stream that was never intended to be a funding stream. It was intended to help fight the war on drugs, not to provide the financial support that's lasting for district attorney's office. And I will point out that Judge Bader Ginsburg, in the decision you referenced, was concerned about that and talked about that in the decision.
Some comments here. One from Kate. This is outrageous. Even a child could understand that this is just a scam by the government to steal things from poor people. A comment from Bill. This sounds like the government is a casino where the house always wins. Maybe if there were penalties for seizing property that ended up belonging to someone innocent, this would happen less. And I did quote from a Cato Institute. It's interesting when you look at some of these more libertarian, even conservative groups and the ACLU, that there is some consensus that civil asset forfeiture is unfair.
Yes, absolutely. What's interesting about this is that the left and the right agree. And as you know, they don't often agree.
No, they don't.
But whether it's the Institute for Justice, the Cato Institute, the ACLU, the Heritage Foundation, both liberal and conservative organizations are out front talking about this abuse, litigating about this abuse, educating the public, because the abuses are so systemic and so widespread. You know, I'll just point out that South Carolina, the Greenville Press, just did a 3-year study in that state, and they found that $17 million were brought into law enforcement agencies during those 3 years from civil forfeiture, with 95% of the funds going to their budgets. And what they found was that civil forfeiture in particular was disparate in terms of its impact on racial minorities as well as poor people. And perhaps we can talk more about that.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break. Then we'll get back to our conversation with Lou Rooley, again, practice professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a critic and authority also on civil asset forfeiture. We're going to take that short break and then we'll be right back. Do stay with us. Don't go away. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Lou Rooley about civil asset forfeiture laws that allow the police to seize a suspect's assets, including things like cash and cars and real estate. And while it has been used during the war on drugs to go after kingpins, it's also ensnared ordinary, even innocent citizens. Today, we're talking about how civil asset forfeiture is being used across the nation and also efforts at reform. Lou, before we get back to our callers and commenters here, you were talking about a case in the South where they saw that it was really used against poor people and against minorities.
Yes. So the Greenville Press did this 3-year study, and what they found was that although black men in South Carolina only make up 13% of the population, they were 65% of the victims of civil forfeiture. And when they looked more closely at those cases, they found that 1 out of 5 were never charged with a criminal offense. And another 1 of the 5 were charged but never convicted of a criminal offense. So it gives you the sense that although civil forfeiture can be used in appropriate situations, it's often used against innocent folks who have limited means and, our criminal justice system, raise very serious issues of disparate impact upon minorities.
Here's a tweet. Could asset forfeiture be used against white-collar criminals? What you just said there, Lou, whether it has been used against white-collar criminals and maybe even some of these drug kingpins we could consider to be white-collar criminals.
Yes, I think that's right. It could be, and again, that would be – we would need to retool this. And so, as I mentioned earlier, you know, 31 states are looking at their civil forfeiture laws. They're beginning to make changes. If civil forfeiture is to continue, and many believe that it should not continue because there is always criminal forfeiture – there is always the ability, if there's a law that permits the forfeiture of property of someone who's been convicted of a crime, to pursue criminal forfeiture. But prosecutors often choose civil forfeiture over criminal forfeiture because all of those safeguards are not there and it's much easier to do so.
Why not just wait until someone's been convicted and then take away their assets?
And so, again, as long as state law or federal law provides that that's okay, they can do that. And that is the argument that – but, you know, in criminal forfeiture, the forfeiture does not begin until a conviction is obtained and the person has right to counsel and you have the safeguards of the criminal process. And so prosecutors often go the easier route of civil forfeiture.
Let me just give out the phone number, and ways that you can join our conversation. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Dan from Winmore to join us. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Besides the conflict of interest of the authorities getting to use the assets, there also seems to be an aspect that the system is rigged. If you seize the assets before someone goes to trial, what lawyer is going to represent them if they don't have assets? And my final question is, how is this not a violation of the final provision of the Fifth Amendment, which says that property should not be taken for public use without just compensation? I know that's often used for eminent domain, but the amendment doesn't restrict it in any way.
Those are great questions, Dan. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lou, can you respond?
Yeah. Let me, for your first point, you know, sometimes civil forfeiture is called state-sanctioned theft and kind of captures this concern that you've raised that how is it that folks can seize their property and before they've been really charged or convicted of a crime? And so that's a major problem with civil forfeiture. The Fifth Amendment, certainly in terms of the taking of property for public purpose, requires compensation in the Fifth Amendment. But the courts have not viewed civil forfeiture as coming within that ambit of the Fifth Amendment. It's not being taken, in essence, for public purpose for which compensation has to be provided. It's more of a penalty for criminal activity. Mm-hmm. And so there we're more in the arena of due process and also in the arena of the Eighth Amendment. And I just wanted to mention that the United States Supreme Court just announced this year, earlier, a very important decision, Timms versus Indiana, a case which really raised the question of the disproportionate impact and the value of property that's being taken versus the gravity of the offense. When they are so disproportionate, shouldn't the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause protect citizens against that? Indiana Supreme Court said no, the Eighth Amendment's excessive fine clause does not apply to Indiana, doesn't apply to the states. Well, interestingly enough, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, and as you know, there are not that many unanimous decisions,
yes,
rebuked that notion and said, yes, the excessive fines clause applies to the states through the 14th Amendment. And so now the role really is for courts to scrutinize the taking of property to make sure that its value is not grossly disproportionate to the gravity of the offense.
Which raises the question, of course, what is an excessive fine? Obviously, depending on what the alleged offense is.
That's right. And one way of looking at that, of course, is what was the statutory fine for the offense, what was actually imposed. In Indiana, Mr. Timms' Land Rover, which he had bought with legitimate funds through an insurance account from his when his father passed away, it was worth $42,000. He was involved in a low-level drug offense, and he was fined around $1,200. The government took his $42,000 car. And the lower court in Indiana said, no, that violates the excessive fines clause. It's disproportionate to the gravity of that offense. And the Supreme Court reversed in Indiana, and that's why it went up to the United States Supreme Court. But now it is clear the excessive fines clause will govern civil forfeiture actions in all of the states. And that's really important because most civil forfeiture actions are really prosecuted in the states when they involve ordinary citizens.
Well, it is interesting to think how this law migrated from being applied to kingpins to people with low-level drug offenses or even people, obviously, who are innocent.
Yes, and that's why there's so much more attention, both in the media and in the courts and in state legislatures, because we've gotten away from the real original purpose of civil forfeiture, and we've abused the constitutional safeguards. And I think courts are beginning to finally recognize that. State legislatures are beginning to recognize that. We certainly are recognizing that in Philadelphia. It's a great example. But there are so many examples of the abuse that are now being communicated to the public. It's not in the shadows. And one example, if I could,
sure, go ahead.
Is so many motorists on the highways that are stopped. And they're stopped for alleged traffic violations, like maybe a broken taillight, or they change lanes without signaling. And what happens is there's no allegation of drugs, but the car is searched, and if there's cash in the car, it's seized. In other words, it's presumed to be illegal cash, even though cash is certainly legal. And then the motorist has to fight to try to get back that cash. And in some places, like Tenaha, Texas, and other hotspots around the country, what we saw was that the police had actual written waivers in their possession and would say to the motorist, sign a waiver giving up all right to this property, or we'll charge you with an offense, we'll arrest you, or if there are children in the car, we'll call the Department of Human Services and have your children taken away. And these are documented examples of how abuse of civil forfeiture can be in the wrong hands and improperly prosecuted.
Is that extortion, what you just described?
Well, many states now at least are looking at this. Some have banned the use of waivers. I think it clearly violates the Constitution. And so whether it raises the level of extortion, I'll leave that for another day.
Here's a Facebook comment from Michael, who says, who decides how seized money is spent? Is there a list of where these funds go?
So another major area here is the lack of transparency. The public does not know how these funds are spent. They're often in private reports that go to the state attorney general's office and then ultimately to a committee of maybe the judiciary committee in the state legislature. But as reporters try to find out how are funds being spent, they're finding that they have to do Right to Know or Freedom of Information Act. Those are being litigated. Every obstacle is being put in the way of the public being informed as to exactly how are these funds being used. And I will tell you that there's a major litigation battle going on in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania right now between the district attorney and the county commissioners. The county commissioners say they have an obligation to audit these funds, to see how they're being spent, to make sure they're being spent for the proper purposes, and the district attorney is resisting that.
And that has to do with auto sales, correct?
That particular situation, yes, is the leasing of expensive automobiles for use by the district attorney.
Anthony wants to know, what are the legal options for people whose assets have been seized? Are they still responsible to pay for their mortgage, for example, if their money has been seized unjustly?
They are. Their obligations continue. And that's why it's important, number one, to get legal help. If you can't afford legal help, to try to seek out where there may be opportunities, like our clinic, for free legal services. But legal help is needed because you're going to want to communicate with those obligation lenders to make sure that they're aware of what's going on and to work with you as you navigate this process. The lenders do have rights under civil forfeiture laws, but of course you don't want to lose your property. You want to save your property and make sure that you're not in a worse financial position because of what has occurred.
Are there calls to use, so assuming civil asset forfeiture remains in some form or another, to use the money for instance, drug rehabilitation programs to get to the root of the problem if it's largely used against drugs?
Yeah, it goes to the question, if we're going to continue civil forfeiture, where should the proceeds go? Some states have said it should all go to education. Let's fund education. Others have said that a good amount of it should go to community drug treatment and prevention programs. And some of it, a very small amount in Pennsylvania, for example, can go there under our state law, but many counties don't choose to send any money there. They keep it all within the prosecutor's office, and Philadelphia has been an example of that. But other states are beginning to say these proceeds ought to go to the Treasury because that's where you have your full accountability, your full transparency as to the funds and how they're being spent and whether or not folks are being accountable for these funds.
Can an argument be made that civil asset forfeiture, which I'm assuming are supposed to make communities better, safer, less crime, that they have worked in any way dealing with that part of the problem?
So when it's used properly and against large kingpins, that can improve communities, no question about it. But, again, prosecutors could use criminal forfeiture for that same purpose. But, yes, there's an argument that we're destabilizing communities. We're driving people deeper into poverty. When we take away their cars, they can't get to employment. They can't get to medical appointments. They can't drive their kids to school. And so they are keeping folks in poverty and, in fact, driving people deeper into poverty. Certainly when folks lose their homes to civil forfeiture. They spiral into homelessness. And so we really do need to examine whether or not in the overview we're hurting communities as we attempt to help communities.
There was a Plan Philly investigation finding something like 41% of forfeited properties in Philadelphia were in four zip codes. What does that tell us?
Yeah, again, the disparate impact upon low-income and minority communities. In our own clinic, we took a sample year, we mapped out all civil forfeitures of homes in Philadelphia. There were 453, I think it was, the year that we examined it. We actually put it on a map so that we could present it to the state legislature in testimony. And not surprisingly, overwhelmingly in North Central Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia, and in portions of Kensington and lower northeast Philadelphia.
These are more low-income parts of the city,
low-income area of the city. And what we also found was that for the expanded center city area, there was only one civil forfeiture petition brought in the entire expanded center city area, and that one petition was brought against an African-American family. So the use of civil forfeiture really raises serious questions about race, which is very much, of course, part of our criminal justice reform efforts.
Well, we're going to have to end that note. Lou Rulli, thanks once again for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's practice professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a critic and an authority on civil asset forfeiture. And he has represented clients trying to get their assets returned. And we began with Bobby Allen, reporter for WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, looking at civil asset forfeiture in Berks County in Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.